You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I've got a great guest with me here this week, David French. David is a senior editor at The Dispatch and a columnist for Time Magazine. David, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we're here today to talk about David's new book, Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. There's the cover for people who are watching us on YouTube. But essentially, the book starts with a premise that would strike people as rather drastic, that America faces a real threat of secession and dividing. But David, I know one thing that's really central to this book is the law of group polarization. So maybe to start, could you just explain that concept for the listeners?
Yeah. So what the law of group polarization holds is that when people of like mind gather, they tend to become more extreme. So let's say you and I get together with a bunch of other guys who are gun rights supporters. We have dinner. We talk about those awful gun controllers. We talk about our arsenals. We talk about why we need guns. At the end of it, are we going to be more dedicated to our position or less dedicated? We're going to be more. Or, you know, they have described it to Christian audiences. Imagine that you go, you don't have to imagine, but, you know, you go to a really good Bible study. It's a really good Bible study. Do you leave the Bible study loving Jesus less? No, you usually leave with more fervor. And what Cass Sunstein did in the 1999 papers, he collected an awful lot of research that shows that when people of like mind gather, just as we're describing, and just as our real life reflects, they tend to become more extreme. And what's interesting is he found that this effect actually over time can be so powerful that over time, an entire group can become more extreme than the most extreme person at the start of the deliberations. So why is this important for right now? Well, it's important for right now because increasingly we're clustering in like-minded communities. So there's this phenomenon called the Big Sort that was outlined in a book by Bill Bishop, I believe in 2009, that said that increasingly we're living and working around people of like mind. Well, what happens when people of like mind gather? They get more extreme. It's one of the reasons why our politics are becoming so polarized, is we're becoming more extreme by living within our own bubbles.
Yeah. So, I mean, most people think of this as echo chambers, right? And what happens in an echo chamber. But like you said, this is documented. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that was interesting to me reading the book is that you start with a retrospective, looking back at pre-Civil War America. And you talk about several things about where the country was at that suggested it was headed for secession or for conflict. What were those things?
Yeah, so you had a distinct geographic region of the United States, a contiguous large geographic region of the United States, the American South, that had a shared culture centered around slavery, believed that culture was under threat. In fact, under threat of extinction, they viewed the election of Lincoln as sort of the signal that there was going to be permanent decline in the power of these slave-owning states in the United States of America. And then they also had this extra ingredient, which was not only did they believe that their culture was under threat, but they believed their own citizens were under mortal threat. So the sense of threat was dramatically amplified. Well, what was one of the, you know, what were some of the things that dramatically amplified that threat? I mean, well, you had the civil unrest in so-called Bleeding Kansas, for example. Well, you had the John Brown raid on Harper's Ferry. In the great book, Battle Cry of Freedom, McPherson's one-volume work, probably the seminal one-volume work on the Civil War, he talked about how John Brown's raid had a real triggering effect on Southern popular opinion. The fact that he would not only raid an arsenal in the attempt to incite a slave rebellion, but also that abolitionists in the North would seize on John Brown as a hero, caused, in McPherson's words, much of the South to be seized in an unreasoning fury. And in fact, if you want to go with the problems of media and fake news and conspiracy theories of the day, the partisan press was a real problem in the run-up to the Civil War. Fake news was a real problem. In fact, there you can read some of these secession documents, and there's actual conspiracy theories in them. For example, Texas its secession document speaks of a plot to poison the people of Texas on the part of these abolitionist forces. And so you had geographically contiguous areas. They believed their slave-owning culture was under threat, and they believed that that threat was increasingly violent. And that combination of factors meant that they felt strong enough to resist, and they felt that they needed to resist as part of their self-defense, and that's what they did. Interestingly, it's a similar analysis in some ways to the American Revolution in 1776, whereas the revolution and the rebellion of the Confederate states was motivated by a desire to preserve this evil institution of slavery. Mm-hmm. The rebellion of the colonists was far more virtuous, a desire to preserve and advance liberty. And so, you know, the underlying reason for the sense of threat can be, you know, you can feel threatened in something that you're wanting to perpetuate that's evil or wrong, as in the South, or you can feel threatened in something that in something that's right and virtuous, or like sort of, for example, a sense of liberty, like the colonists in 1775 and 1776, even though, of course, we know that they were highly imperfect in their application of liberty. The right. Aspiration of liberty was virtuous.
So you had these people who were geographically separated, culturally distinct, economically distinct, and they believed fundamentally that the other group was a threat to them. Right. Now, at the beginning, when I opened the book for the first time, I started out kind of skeptical that we could really be in the same place, that it could really be that bad. But you lay out that these same phenomenons are all in place in American life today as it grows more polarized and more siloed. And so can you explain why you came to actually view the situations as comparable?
Yeah, so several reasons. One is that I saw, especially after I got back from Iraq, I served in Iraq from 07 to 08. I came back to a country that was polarizing at a rapid rate. And I noticed a material change in the polarization even from before I left Iraq. I also noticed some commonalities with the kind of polarization that I saw in Iraq, because I was in Iraq during the surge, which was in the middle of an Iraqi civil war. And I saw that a lot of the polarization was based on a sense of deep sense of grievance, that both sides, right and left in America, had a narrative, a story of wrongdoing that one side or the other had inflicted on them. And that was one thing I noticed in Iraq that was so dangerous, was this reality that Sunni and Shia, yeah, they had theological differences for sure. They had differences in philosophy of governance or how they wanted to govern Iraq, for sure. But deeper than that is they had a narrative of grievance. I have to get vengeance on the Sunni because the Sunni killed my nephew, or I have to get vengeance on the Shia because the Shia killed my uncle. And it was that narrative of grievance. And I began to see that narrative of grievance taking hold. And it was taking hold in a country that wasn't just divided politically, it was divided geographically, with giant geographically contiguous areas like the entire west coast of the U.S., overwhelmingly supermajority blue, much of the southeast and Midwest, supermajority red, the northeast, supermajority blue. And all of these have an enormous amount of economic power all on their own. They have cultural common characteristics and creating a real sense. And you see it all the time in two Americas. And I was saying you really might have two or three Americas when you think about it. But that's all quite alarming. And so you had a lot of these common factors from 1859, 1860, 1861, geographically contiguous, common cultures that believed they were under threat. And I said that the ingredient that's lacking, and I finished this book in mid to late March of 2020, the thing that's lacking is that violent spark that you had in 1859 and 1860. And since that time, I'm not saying we're going to divide now. I'm not going to say we're going to divide any time, but I am going to say that all of the trends that I identified in the book have only accelerated since I wrote the book. And then that sense of violence and the actual violence and the sense of fear that existed in the 1850s is growing in the United States of the 2020s.
Yes. I mean, some books really don't age well. Some books age fine, but some things turn out differently. If anything, this book, which came out officially a couple months ago, it seems like the thesis of your book has only become more relevant, right? So how do recent events from, you know, the Capitol attack to the election denials and all of this, did they just confirm everything you'd witnessed? Did you reevaluate anything? Did you speed up your timeline that you were concerned about this? How does it all work in?
Well, you know, I think what the events of the last 8-9 months have done is sort of confirm the underlying thesis itself. And the underlying thesis itself is that because of the dramatic divisions within American society, there is no truly important cultural or political or religious force that is pulling Americans together more than it's pushing us apart. And so what ends up happening is every single external additional event that occurs in the United States is overlaid upon these forces that are pulling us, that are pushing us apart. And so, for example, coronavirus. If coronavirus fell upon even a decently unified country, even a decently healthy body politic, it would be a unifying force. It would be the kind of thing that we would say, well, there's nobody in particular to blame for this. This is, you know, there was no way to keep the pandemic from approaching our shores, but we can together confront it. Instead, we ended up with ludicrous culture wars over things like wearing a mask in a pandemic that is with empowered by a respiratory disease. And you're having culture wars over masking. A healthy society does not have the kind of culture of the war that we had over masking, for example. Or you have this, you know, these awful examples of police brutality and violence that we saw, you know, from the Breonna Taylor killing or to the George Floyd murder. And in a healthy society, yeah, there's going to be friction that's created about that, but it's going to create a sense of revulsion, a united sense of revulsion that will lead to some concrete legal reforms. And for a while, for a very brief time, it looked like that might happen. Instead, though, it devolved into violent riots on the one hand and condemnations of wokeism on the other hand. And at the end of the day, we're not any closer to actually protecting the Bill of Rights in many of these marginalized communities than we were before the events occurred, but we are far more divided. And so what's ended up happening, and then we have an election where the outcome is clear, but because of the level of mistrust and distrust and because of the abysmal character of the president of the United States, it's like pouring gasoline onto a bonfire. And so all of these events, from the coronavirus epidemic to the outbreak of violence following these awful police killings to the election itself, every one of those has been layered on top of an already dysfunctional body politic and made the body politic more dysfunctional.
Right. So I think the second part of your book was particularly interesting for me because, like you, I'm a fiction fantasy fan, and you essentially wrote out these secession scenarios, and you wrote them in like the tense as if you were recounting a history that didn't actually happen, like it could have been a fiction short story, right? So
exactly.
One, is there a novel in your future? Because I really enjoyed reading those parts. Did you anticipate doing almost fiction style writing when you started to write a book?
Yeah, this book? Well, you know, the reason why I wanted to do that, and this is something that I worked with the publisher on, we sort of brainstormed it together, was I wanted to make it concrete. Because it's one thing to sort of say, oh, well, you know, there's this sociological study and there's this anecdote that advances this sociological study and there's this polling trend and then there's this cultural phenomenon, which really sort of makes your book kind of a sociology book, you know, for lack of a better term, a political book, a sociology book. But it doesn't connect in this quite the same way, because you have a provocative thesis that says the country could come apart. Well, the thought was, how can we make the thesis real? Like, how can we plug in all of these trends that are very real and make it come alive? And that's these middle fictional chapters that take all of the trends of the present day and connect them with a scenario where all these trends continue into a, you know, sort of a medium term future. And it really is the pivot of the book. Either the fictional scenarios work or they don't. And if they don't work, it kind of undermines the whole thing. But the feedback that I've gotten from people has been really interesting. A number of people have said, particularly about the Cal exit chapter that I outlined, that it took them, they were reading several pages into it before they even realized it was fiction.
Yeah. So I'll say I enjoyed the whole book, but that was by far the most engrossing part of the book. And I think, like, I read it several weeks ago now, it's the part that stands out the clearest in my memory. But so everybody should read the book, and the link will be in the description down below. But just for the Cliff Notes version, for the purposes of this conversation, can you lay out the short version of the Cal exit scenario in which California could secede from the United States?
Yeah, well, so in both the Cal exit and the Texas scenario have actual echoes to right now in different ways. So the Cal exit scenario is quite simply that there's a string of mass shootings in California after California has attempted gun control and after the Supreme Court, a majority Supreme Court nominated and confirmed by presidents who did not win the popular votes in their elections, has struck down California's gun control laws, culminating in an awful, terrible, horrible school shooting that is just beyond, you know, in the Sandy Hook and beyond category. And and so California responds by saying, we're going to not ban guns, but essentially ban every kind of gun that could be used for a mass shooting. And we're not going to have a grandfather clause. We're not going to delay enforcement of the law. We're going to start enforcing it. And the district court allows it to go forward. The Ninth Circuit allows it to go forward. California law enforcement begins enforcing the law, and militia members resist, and that triggers a series of violent confrontations that are occurring simultaneously with a Supreme Court hearing over the validity of the law. And one of the things that these scenarios depend on is a political class that is very much like the political class that existed before the Civil War. And some have labeled it sort of the blundering generation, the class that existed before the Civil War, that politicians, rather than being principled, are opportunistic, and that they see opportunity in division, and they even see opportunity in secession. Essentially what they are in, what it's laying out is a crisis created by a clash between state autonomy and federal power, where the state government feels as if the federal power is putting their lives at risk.
Right. And one thing that I wondered about the California exit scenario, and this might honestly sound bad, but I really worry about the future of the country. And I feel like people are so divided, and they don't understand the other side, and they hate each other, and things are getting worse and worse and worse. The end scenario didn't seem horrible to me. I mean, I love America, but I kind of left at the end of that scenario with California independent. There was no outbreak of war between the two, if I recall correctly, right? DC wasn't nuking Los Angeles. But California went, and with other West Coast leftist states, could go have their own rules and life, and the other parts of the country could live in their own way. And it's sad, but it almost seemed like not the worst outcome in the world. Am I missing something?
Well, you know, that's funny. One of the most frequent questions I get after the book, people read the book, is, well, why should we stay together? Which is not what I expected. I expected, you know, what can we do to stop this? You know, but that's one of the reasons why I wrote the third. I had three fictional scenarios. One was Cal exit, one was Texit, and the other one was a world on fire. What is the world like when America divides? And so the answer that I have to this is sort of twofold. It's principled and it's pragmatic. So here's the principled answer. The principled answer to why stay together is America's aspirations are good. you know, the principles of the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, the Civil War amendments, these are among some of the best political ideas ever advanced by the mind of man. Now, we have not always lived up to them. We don't live up to them ideally now, today. We certainly do better than we did in 1860, 1861, in 1776, and 1964. We do better. We don't live up to them all. But these are good and virtuous ideas, and there is nothing to say that in a highly divided, uncertain, angry, defensive, furious atmosphere, that whatever emerges from the ashes of the United States of America, or even not the ashes, the division of the United States of America, would be as good. In fact, the odds are that it would not be, because it would be forged in fear and anger and rage. It would probably not be. And the other thing is the pragmatic element of this is we really have become the indispensable country in the world. When you look at world history, we're on a multi-decade, multi-generation period without any major great power conflict, without a World War III, for example, and where there has been just an unbelievable amount of growth of human prosperity, elimination in many places of poverty, the diminution of poverty, especially of absolute poverty. And when you remove America from that, what I say is it's not like the old hatreds have gone away. They've often just sort of been suppressed or controlled or channeled. And one of the arguments that I make is that what you might see is a quite literally a world on fire, where there isn't the barrier to the old hatreds, where there isn't the barrier to the reassertion of the old order, which was often disorder. And so, which would mean more violence, it would mean more war, and America could never insulate itself from that. It would mean more misery for Americans. So there's a principled and there's a pragmatic reason for it, in addition to just the awful pain of the event itself. I don't think there would be a civil war. I don't think our military would fight itself the way the military did in 1861, starting in 1861. But, and I don't think there'd be the stomach for people like parents in Texas to send their kids to die for California to stay in the Union. I don't think there'd be a civil war. There would be violence to some degree. It would be a very friction. There would be a lot of friction. It'd be miserable. It'd be horrible. It'd be contentious. It'd be immiserating. But I don't think it'd be a war. So it'd be a miserable thing. It'd be a miserable event that would destabilize the world and would probably deprive the world of a nation built on some of the best ideals that political man has conceived.
So you might find this interesting then, but when I read the third scenario about the world on fire, I almost came away with the impression that despite all the conflicts you described that would break out, all the problems, it was a slightly rosy scenario. And maybe this is my dystopian fiction and apocalyptic fiction coming in, but is there not a scenario where the U.S. divides and then the ensuing chaos ends up leading to nuclear war or ends up leading to Chinese boots on the ground in the United States?
Well, I don't know about Chinese boots on the ground in the United States, but the way it ended up was you have nuclear-armed Japan, nuclear-armed South Korea, nuclear-armed Taiwan, nuclear-armed China. They all fought a war with each other. You have Russia having fractured NATO into a million pieces. You have the great powers of Europe glaring at each other again in the way they did, you know, pre-World War I and pre-World War II. And the fractured remnants of the U.S. at a moderate level world power and unable to master events. And so, and that was a better case scenario. So yeah, I didn't map out the absolute worst case because I didn't want it to seem like I was just going full apocalypse for the sake of going full apocalypse. I was trying to be as reasonably realistic as I could.
And in all of these scenarios, everything is completely realistic, right? It's not as if it's like science fiction where you're flexing with the rules. Like it was all done according to how the Supreme Court would operate, how the states, everything was really, really mapped out. So what was that like to think through that and to go and think and find out what the minute mechanisms would be? I mean, was that a sobering experience?
Well, I just leaned a lot on my own experience. you know, having served in the military, I know about the military capabilities of our allies. I know about the military capabilities of our potential enemies. You know, having been a lawyer for 20 plus years, I know the ins and outs of the Supreme Court and the courts of appeal. Being a Second Amendment advocate, I particularly know about gun control laws. You know, so I kind of, and being pro-life activist, I'm because the Texas scenario deals with the overturning of Roe and the friction that that causes. So I tried to stick to my knitting, to the things that I knew, so that I didn't want the reader to be distracted in the sense that, oh, well, this is obviously unrealistic. So the best way to avoid that kind of disaster is just stick to your knitting, stick to what you know, and talk about what you know and project from what you know.
And so you, the book is not all despair, right? You identify a way out. And that rests in part around what you call pluralism and tolerance. So yeah. Could you just explain to listeners what your vision is? What do you mean when you say tolerance? What do you mean by pluralism?
Yeah. And so that's really important because you have to define your terms here, because most conservatives, and I, you know, I come from the world of conservatism. You know, I'm a never Trump conservative, and I think that my conservatism drives my never Trumpism, quite frankly. So we conservatives have long gotten burned by the word tolerance, because particularly in universities, tolerance often means intolerance. It's, you know, in the name of tolerance, there is an awful lot of intolerance. For example, in university speech codes are a prime example of intolerance in the name of tolerance. And so what I try to do is sort of rediscover the real meaning of the word. And I was inspired to do that by an essay written not long ago by a guy who writes under the pseudonym Scott Alexander. And he was taught, I believe a psychologist, lives in a blue state friends, progressive friends. And he was talking to them about tolerance. And he said, he's asking them, are you tolerant? And they said, sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, we love everybody regardless of race, sex, gender identity, sexual orientation. And then so Scott asked the next question. Okay, so what's wrong with them? What do you mean, what's wrong with them? We love everybody. And then he says, well, then what are you tolerating? In other words, tolerance implies not affection, but acceptance. It says there's something to tolerate. There's something to overlook in accepting someone into your community. And this is what we've lost. We've lost any sense in many of our communities that we're willing to overlook anything to accept someone in our community. I mean, think of like sort of the growth of cancel culture where, yeah, you know, I might like David, but have you read this tweet from 2015? Well, then I'm evil. It's not, we don't look at it like if somebody's my 80% friend, in other words, agreeing with me 80% of the time and disagreeing 20%. We look at that as they're not my 80% friend. They're my 100% enemy, because that last 20%, they got to close that gap. And so we've just lost any sort of willingness to accept, for lack of a better term, wrongness in another person.
So for me, the most interesting example of the tolerance question, because I come from the LGBT community, right? And the most glaring public example of what tolerance is not is forcing a Christian baker with the state to customize a cake for your wedding, right? In a tolerant society, he wouldn't have to bake me the cake and I could do what I want and he could do what he wants in our own lives and nobody would be forcing on the others. And you don't have to like it. You don't have to like what the other person believes. You just have to tolerate it. And part of the way in the book that you describe this could be done is through federalism and states' rights. So maybe you could lay out what you envision that looking like, because that's something that's often talked about, and especially, or it's kind of pandered to by like Republican politicians, but the actual conservative people who believe in this actually have a vision for it like you do. So I'd be interested to hear that, because it's become kind of a cheap slogan in some circles, but you really flesh it out in the book.
Yeah. So a lot of people, when they hear federalism, or especially when they hear states' rights, they just, gross, because that is Jim Crow. That's slavery. What I talk about in the book is there is a difference between that kind of federalism and the healthy federalism that I talk about. So healthy, what healthy federalism does is it says that every state of the union has to provide all Americans with equal access to the Bill of Rights. In other words, there's no federalism of the First Amendment. I'm not sure what state you're in, Brad, but
Virginia.
You're in Virginia. I'm in Tennessee. There should not be two free speech doctrines. Like if I drive over the border from, if I drive from Tennessee to Virginia, I shouldn't have less or fewer free speech rights when I arrive in Virginia. I shouldn't have fewer due process rights. I shouldn't have fewer rights against cruel and unusual punishment, for example. All of those things should be preserved equally. The old federalism was a federalism of the Bill of Rights. It said quite literally, you know, if you were a Black American and you crossed the border into the South, you had none of the Bill of Rights, practically none of them. And so what I'm saying is we need to correct that error of federalism, which was to create a diversity in our application of the fundamental American social compact embodied by the Bill of Rights and the Civil War amendments. So protecting free speech for all, religious liberty for all, due process for all, you know, all of these fundamental American rights across the board, you then allow for greater variation in things like tax policy, education policy, pensions, healthcare, climate. So the desire is to take all of these things that we have now nationalized to such a great degree and de-escalate national politics, push them down as close as possible to local communities. And in that circumstance, you will have some opportunity to breathe, to where every national election is not the be-all and end-all, and that each American political community has a true opportunity to enact its values into policy.
So this is, to me, in the abstract, it really compelling. And it's something I think would solve a lot of the problems. But the thing that makes me a little bit skeptical about how viable a solution is two things. But first and foremost, most Americans don't seem content to live and let live.
No, they
seem to really want to not just have their own live their life they want, but to force their views on others, whether we're talking right or left. Yeah. So how far removed is the American body politic where it is right now from the kind of disposition they would need to accept this as a solution?
Far. I mean, let's just be honest about it. I mean, I like the way you framed it in a question a little while ago. You said tolerance and pluralism. Well, tolerance has to precede pluralism because you cannot have pluralism if you're not going to at least have a degree of tolerance. And so there has to be, I was in a book club talking about my book earlier this week, and they said, it sounds like you're calling for something of like almost like a revival, but not really of revival, because you're not calling for a true change of heart of everybody. It's really modest. You're not calling on everyone to love each other. It's not all a kumbaya. It is just tolerate each other. Just tolerate. And so there has to be some heart change that precedes, that is before the policy change. Because right now there's no all federalism right now is a tactic. It's not a principle. You know, you see this on both sides. I mean, you know, during the Obama administration, the state of Arizona tried to go its own way in tightening immigration enforcement. Obama administration came down like a ton of bricks on it. Supreme Court came down like a ton of bricks on Arizona. And all the conservatives were like, federalism, federalism, federalism. So then here rolls around the Trump administration. California tries to go its own way, saying, you know, we're not going to prohibit the enforcement of federal law, but we're also not going to facilitate the enforcement of federal law. We're going to create these sanctuary cities, be a sanctuary state, which that's federalism. You may not like it, but that's federalism. And so what did the Trump administration do? It tried to come down on them like a ton of bricks. And you'll have these example after example that when you're in power in Washington, you kind of want everybody to fall in line. When you're not in power in Washington, you're like, federalism. But you forget that the instant you win. And so that's why it has not, one of the reasons why it has not worked right now. And so the book is a call for a heart change that will trigger a policy change. And the policy change can help us live together, even if and when hearts harden again.
So I guess the second kind of cause for skepticism I have is that the idea of the Bill of Rights being something states have to abide by, right? And then the policy flexibility at the state and local levels, things like environmental regulation and healthcare policy and tax policy. Well, when I think about the issues that are most polarizing, I think abortion and guns, just like in your two scenarios.
Yeah, yeah.
But in both cases, those strike me as issues where the Constitution, one party perceives, does not allow experimentation at the state level, right? As a conservative, I don't think that California gets to, under the U.S. Constitution, ban most guns, right? So I don't think that I think what they would feel they need to do to be able to live in their own state in the Federalist vision violates the conservative idea of what the Constitution protects. And on the flip side, the only way I think states would really, or America would really, get over the polarization is if every state could make their own abortion laws. But progressives see that as, and I don't agree with them, and I imagine you don't either, but they see that as a violation of women's constitutional right to abortion. Right. So in both scenarios, it seems like the Federalist answer doesn't solve the issue because neither side accepts what the other side perceives the Bill of Rights to entail.
Right, because in both of my scenarios, the heart change has not occurred, that the tolerance idea has already been rejected. So the Bill of Rights is a sort of a constant, is not a guarantee of a frictionless America. It's not. There's no way that in a nation this diverse, in a nation this, you know, with that's increasingly diverse every year, more diverse religiously, more diverse ethnically, more diverse racially, you name it. It's just more diverse every year, that we're going to achieve this sort of utopia of unity. And so my argument is that what has to happen is a step one and a step two. A step one is the degree of tolerance. The step two is the degree of pluralism. My scenarios are, you don't even get to step one. That the intolerance builds and builds and builds to where the existing friction that we have, even over the Bill of Rights and that we've been fighting over for 20, 30 years, just builds until it breaks. But under my scenario, my suggested scenario, there's a degree of tolerance. And there's a time when, you know, I keep going back to when I'm asked about this, you know, in 1992 on the abortion issue, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that if Roe's scope was less, and this is the word she used, breathtaking, that perhaps American division would not be so sharp. She was lamenting the breadth of the Roe decision. This was Ginsburg. There were many people, including progressives, who lamented the breadth of the Roe decision, even, you know, back in the 1970s. And so what we have here is, and as far as gun rights go, I'm more than willing to, I mean, I don't necessarily believe that the natural reading of the Second Amendment is the extent of gun rights that I would like to enjoy. Now, I think a state could maybe grant more rights, but I don't think, for example, the Second Amendment means necessarily that I should enjoy the right of quote unquote constitutional carry that a lot of very conservative states have enacted. So in some of those areas, there is a real sense of there, you know, there needs to be a sense of tolerance, of a permitting of disagreement on these issues. But at the same time, in the Bill of Rights, there's a bottom line. No, so I think Roe should be overturned. I think abortion should be sent back to the states. Now, over time, I would hope we'd develop a culture of life so overpowering that abortion would essentially disappear and that a human life amendment would become a non-controversial piece of overwhelming American consensus. We're a ways from that, but abortion is declining in the U.S. and has been declining for, you know, 40 years or so. But what my scenarios say is if the tolerance piece of this, if the heart change piece of this doesn't move and our hearts get harder, the normal disagreements that we have become more grave, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And everybody, that is just the beginning of everything David lays out in his book. which you will find in the link below for the episode description. So now for the part of the show that everybody likes the most, David, hit us with your controversial food take.
Chick-fil-A is by far not the best fast food chicken. That might get me thrown out of the conservative movement. Well, I think I'm already thrown out because of Trump.
Yeah,
I'm already out. I might as well just, now that the walls have come up, the gate is locked. Zaxby's is better. Kentucky Fried Chicken is better.
Oh,
Popeyes is better.
I will say I like the Popeyes chicken sandwich better than the Chick-fil-A chicken sandwich, spicy chicken sandwich.
Yeah. No, I think the Chick-fil-A dining experience is enjoyable because the Chick-fil-A culture is awesome. You know, my pleasure, you know, super nice people, the dining experience, but the food is not as good as some other chicken, as other fast food chicken outlets.
Yeah, and that
don't
might
sleep on, don't sleep on KFC.
That doesn't outrage me. It will probably outrage some people, but I have always thought like Chick-fil-A is decent, but extremely overhyped.
Yeah. Yeah. It does not merit the adoration. Let's just put it that way.
Well, everybody, that is it for this episode. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll be back again next week.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.